Good morning.
I'd like to begin this first session of our final weekend course together with the meditation on loving kindness that we have done before, remembering the kindness of mother, father, family, friends, and so on, and generating our mind in any aspect of loving kindness towards those close to us and those distant from us. I think we have to constantly remember that the positive attitudes of mind that in Buddhism that we train our mind to have are not just the intellectual knowledge of good to be generous, good to be patient, good to be compassionate, kind, and so on. But it's an actual attitude of mind, it's a state of mind that takes over the whole mental consciousness. So we have to cultivate the habit of they use the term generating the mind. Even a synonym for conventional bodhicitta is mind generation. So the generation means actively cultivating or developing our mind in this positive aspect towards others or to whatever the object is. So when we do the meditation on remembering mother's kindness, father's kindness, and so on, there is our mind is, it's visualizing, it's imagining. We can't remember when we were little babies how our mother was kind to us, but we can infer that happened. I mean, the very reason that we survived childhood was because every baby thrives on love and affection and care. Because they won't totally die, or some could, but to have some sort of reasonable, balanced, stable personality is very much dependent upon the love and the attention we receive as children. But we've forgotten. But it happened. So as we reflect upon kindness of mothers in general towards children, whether they're human mothers or animal mothers, it's a reality. And it's a natural attitude, the protectiveness and the care and the affection of the mother towards the child. It's not something that's religious. Something that comes from following a particular religion or philosophy. It is a natural state of the mind, whether you're human, whether you're animal, whatever realm you're born into, there is this natural affection. However, because of our self-centered ignorance, as we grow up, we become so self-centered in our attitude towards others, grasping, greedy, wanting more, and aggression, and so on. And so, being completely involved in what I want and what I don't want, we actually inhibit our natural capacity for love. It's even like we're seeking our life partner, then we're quite reserved in giving love. One reason is that we've done it before and we've been rejected or abandoned and we feel hesitant about exposing ourselves. Well, what we imagine is exposing ourselves to the danger of further rejection. That the person does not reciprocate the the love that we express towards them. So we're inhibited. And so we suppress this natural love. So the meditation on loving kindness very much needs to dissolve away those psychological inhibitions to be our natural self. And we have to realize that being our natural self is not exposing ourselves to danger. The pain that we feel when nobody will love us, or somebody loves us and then rejects us, the pain is not from their rejection or their simply not loving us. The pain is self-created, inasmuch as we live with this false image of a true real me who is going through life, and true real me experiencing this, experiencing that, and so always craving, wanting, very so self-conscious, so sensitive, but we don't realize that the self we imagine ourselves to be in our self-consciousness is a figment of our imagination. Nevertheless, not knowing that, we become inhibited. And Lama Dzogchen Rinpoche, I'm giving the example. You know, you have a couple, and married couple, raising family, etc. And one of them starts having an affair with somebody else, but the other one doesn't know it, completely unaware. And the one who has an affair is directing his or her love towards another person and has stopped loving their married partner. This can go on for weeks, months, even years. And the one who is unaware is quite happy, living life and doing what needs to be done. But then one day they discover that their partner, their spouse, has an affair and is not interested in them and is loving somebody else. And upon that discovery, then they completely fall apart. Completely. Despair, misery, self-pity, anguish, even to the point of suicide. So, Lama Dzogchen made the point that their partner, who had gone off, who had having an affair with somebody else, had stopped loving them 2 years previously. But unaware of that, they'd been balanced and lived their ordinary life. So, the one who's totally fallen apart, feels rejected and abandoned, they instantly blame their partner for rejection and everything as the cause of the problem. But if that were so, then the pain and despair would have been experienced 2 years previously. But it wasn't. So the totally distraught, miserable mind, the source came from oneself, from the shattering of our self-image, because the self-image that we live with and consider to be the real me, the self-confidence, the high self-esteem, is cultivated in dependence upon others. As little babies, our self-consciousness is cultivated and depends upon the love and kindness of mother. And that's a very necessary thing. You know, there's no fault in that. It's part of being a child and beginning to grow up in this life, relying upon the affection and care and love of mother, father, and extended family, friends, and so on. But as adults, when we choose a partner, our stability is still that childlike or infantile. It's built up on that infantile reliance upon the affection of another. Now, our soulmate or our partner. And so, what has happened is that we are completely dependent upon the constant affection of others, in particular our partner. Like a child is completely dependent on the mother's love. But you know, as I've said before in these talks, children also depend upon the milk from the mother's breast for their physical growth, but they're weaned from the breast. But as we grow up, they're not completely weaned from their mother's heart, from mother's love. And as adults, as long as we rely upon the affection of others, we still haven't been weaned from the initial requirement for love and affection. So we are always, we don't know this, but we're always living under the threat of not getting the external attention, love, affection that we crave. And we can live our whole life and die still craving the affection, the kindness of others. So what it means to be weaned from the need for the love and affection of mother, father, family, friends, partner, is to generate, now we're getting back to generate our mind in this outgoing, healing, blissful energy of loving kindness and consciously direct it towards others. Without worrying whether it's reciprocated by another or not. And it often isn't. That as much as we feel genuine fondness and kindness and love towards others, they criticize us. Parents see it with their children. The children, again, that's part of growing up, rejecting mum and dad, and trying to establish your own independence in life. And even, I think, part of that feeling of need to establish independence is some subconscious recognition that I still rely upon mum and dad. You know, I need, well, not only for their love, but as we grow older, for the money that's in their wallet, the material support. And probably, maybe a conscious or even a subconscious feeling of this isn't right. You know, I'm not the independent person that I want to be. The independent, self-sufficient person that I know I can be, but somehow, and there's this reliance, and almost we feel resentment towards mum and dad for this connection. And of course, it gets complicated, doesn't it? Because mum and dad's ego, their self importance, their sense of self-esteem is invested in us, in their children. And so they want their children to do what they think the ideal child should do. Be very outgoing, to succeed at school, to be in the top of the class, in examinations, in sport, and so on. And so there's this subtle, and sometimes not so subtle, overt pressure from mum and dad to manipulate the child to conform to their projections of what my child should be like. So there's incredible conflict, isn't there? So much conflict between the child's mind and the parent's mind, and it can be completely shattering for family relationships. So in the Buddhist path, Buddha said we have to wean ourselves from the need for the affection. And how do we do it? By generating the power and energy of genuine love and affection radiating from our mind towards others. In that way, then we're self-sufficient. That gives us so much confidence, so much capacity to deal with the things that go wrong in life, in whatever situation we're in. So this meditation is so important because we train in generating our mind in the aspect of love, and we visualize it as blissful white light filling our body and so on. So as you do the meditation, really don't do it intellectually, but do it with feeling in your heart that is actually happening. All right. Okay, so sit comfortably with your back straight, hands resting in your lap. And this meditation also is the motivation for participating in the whole weekend's discussion of the 12 links. So begin by focusing your whole attention on the coming and going of your breath at the nostrils. Don't follow distracting thoughts, merely observe them arising, and then if you don't pay attention to them, they also fade away into the recesses of your mind. And your clear attention should be held on the sensation of the air entering and leaving your nostrils with each breath. Now imagine your mother looking young and healthy as she was when you were born. Think that she's meditating beside you on your left side. Then think of how you yourself, when you were born, were a helpless baby, frightened of all that's happening outside, not knowing what's going on, and your sole refuge was your mother. The sound of her voice, the touch of her body, brought calm to your mind. She was your protector. She was your nurse. She fed you. She cleaned you. Was always there when you needed her. And as you were growing up, she taught you how to walk, how to talk, how to enjoy your five senses. And all of the energy that she invested upon you, all that she required was your smiles and laughter. You think of your relationship with your mother when you were very young, of her kindness towards you. And as you do so, feel the warmth of love towards her arising in your heart, a blissful, warm feeling. Imagine appearing as light pouring out from your heart. Imagine that this blissful light of love pouring out from your heart fills your entire body from head to toe, and as it does so, it heals and removes all physical and mental problems and their causes. if you have a particular illness with an organ, lungs, heart, kidneys, liver, whatever, specifically, it totally washes away that illness and its causes. Now think that your mother, meditating beside you, wherever she is now, still in this life, or even in her future life, you have direct communication with her, heart to heart, and you send a stream of this blissful, healing light of love from your heart to her heart, so that her body too, in real time now, becomes filled with that nectar, that light of love, and all physical and mental problems that she may have are totally washed away and brought to an end. And she experiences great peace and happiness. Think that you are repaying her kindness towards you when you were young. Now imagine your father, young and healthy, as he was when you were born, meditating on your right. And similarly, think of all that he's done for you, his kindness, and then send a stream of the blissful, healing light of love to him, so that where he is now, you have heart-to-heart communication, and all of his mental and physical problems and their causes are removed. Then imagine the remainder of your family and friends all meditating behind you. And thinking of each one in turn, generate love and send the blissful, healing light of love from your heart to their heart as before. Now imagine meditating in front of you and facing you are those towards whom you feel dislike, even anger, who have harmed you or your family and friends, or even distant political figures towards whom you feel dislike. And then understanding that from their side, their minds are totally out of control, self-centeredness, anger, attachment, and so on, and that they are suffering as a result. And from your side, seeing them as inherently, existingly bad is wrong, and your dislike and anger towards them is like a mental cancer that eats away at your happiness and peace of mind. As long as you dislike someone, you can't ever be truly peaceful. So generate forgiveness for whatever harm they've caused you, and also remember that in past lives they've been as kind to you as your present mother and father. And then send streams of the blissful healing nectar of love from your heart to their hearts as well. then imagine all universal sentient beings, all the remaining ones, in the aspect of humans, meditating all around you as far as the horizon. And aware that at different stages in your past lives, they've all been your mother and father countless times. And so from your heart, send out wave after wave of the blissful healing energy of love, like a supernova illuminating the entire galaxy. And imagine that your love touches the hearts of all universal beings, removing all suffering and its causes, and leading them to full enlightenment, even transforming their environments into pure lands. And finally, think that all the beings visualized around you, mother, father, and all sentient beings, family, have all achieved enlightenment. Their pure environments melt into light and absorb into them, and they all melt into light, becoming oneness with the Dharmakaya, omniscient wisdom body of a Buddha, of Buddhahood. All that remains is your own body floating like a bubble in empty space. The ordinary outline is there, but inside is filled with the blissful light of universal love. Then think that your own body dissolves away into empty space from the outside in. The last point to go is at your heart, and your blissful mind remains single-pointedly focused upon your ultimate nature of emptiness of inherent existence, appearing like clear empty space. Then within that clear space of emptiness, your mind appears in the form of bodhicitta, the intention to achieve enlightenment, to guide all beings out of suffering. So that energy of bodhicitta appears as light, which takes the form of your old body with your mind inside. Think that your old body and mind, derived from karma and disturbing emotions, has gone forever. And now your body and mind are the products of wisdom and compassion. So that the entire purpose for your existence, for your life, everything that you think, do and say, will be for the benefit of others, to ease their sufferings however you can, and guide them on the path to enlightenment, however they are capable at the present time. So maintaining your mind in the aspect of bodhicitta, you can now gradually relax and stop the meditation. Now we go back to the classroom. The notes that you may have on your tablets or that were printed out that I prepared for this weekend. So, beginning at the beginning again, in discussion of the topic of dependent origination, then we refresh our memory of the classification of things that exist. Just to be clear, so at the beginning of the first page, there is all existing things. Whatever exists belongs to one of two categories: the category of changing things, things which change moment by moment, or are impermanent, and things which don't change moment by moment, unchanging. For example, what we call uncaused space, like that refers to the not space as we talk about in quantum physics, but just the mere absence of obstructive contact. So there's this mere absence exists everywhere. It's not a thing in itself, but it is something that exists. If there were obstructive contact, then the world couldn't spin on its axis, the world couldn't revolve around the sun, and the Milky Way couldn't go around the center of our solar system can't go around the center of the Milky Way, and the Milky Way itself can't expand rapidly. So we know all of these movements are happening, incredibly complex, constant movement, that the space, that we inhabit is totally changing because of the unbelievable speed and different directions it's moving. So that happens because there's no obstruction. So that's the meaning of space in this context. We can talk about caused space, like visible space, like there's a few spaces here for people to sit. They're empty cushions. So we can see that with our eyes. So that is visual space. So that's not the uncaused space. That somebody can sit there and then there's no more space there. All right. So uncaused space just doesn't change moment by moment. It's simply there. Emptiness, the emptiness of inherent existence, the ultimate nature of oneself and others and whatever exists, means that nothing exists in its own right or from its own side. So that is a quality that we have possessed since, well, in this life, since we were born. Our ultimate nature has always been emptiness of inherent existence. And that's something, even though our body has changed, our mind has changed, as we grew up, our ultimate nature of emptiness has not changed. It's just been constant. So that is another example of an existing thing which is unchanging. True cessation refers to when we generate the direct wisdom realizing emptiness, then progressively the power of that wisdom causes abandonment forever of different levels of afflictions or disturbing emotions in our mind. So that's another emptiness. The absence, first of intellectual afflictions, intellectually acquired, and then the progressive cessation of innate afflictions from our mind. So that true cessation is an emptiness in the mind that doesn't change moment by moment. Okay, so that is changing things and unchanging things. Now, the next table is a breakdown of things which are changing. So, there are three categories. The whole physical world, which includes not just atoms and molecules, but the energies, you know, electric, magnetic, radiation, gravity, and so on. And even what in quantum physics refers to the quanta of space, there's a particulate characteristic even of space. And Buddhism agrees. His Holiness often refers to space particles, the most, how do you say, refined, the most minute, the most simple manifestation of form of the physical world. So, and that's changing moment by moment. So, at a more gross level, the physical world includes our bodies, the objects of our five senses, you know, sights, shapes, and colors, sounds, smells, tastes, intangibles. The sense powers refers to more subtle physical matter, like related to the retina, the eye, the particular nervous constructions within our ears, which enable our ear organ to perceive sounds, as well as the connection with the brain. And so similarly, smell, taste and touch, they have this subtle nervous system capable of responding and enabling the mind to be aware of the sensory world. So that's what we call the sense powers. Then a third category of physical things are forms, which is a general term for physical things, which are only they can't be perceived by the five senses, but our mental consciousness can be aware of them, such as a single atom, you know, the atomic particles, etc., cannot be seen by the eyes, but they can be inferred by mental consciousness, so conceptually and correctly, and even if we develop the power of our mind through meditation, it can actually perceive directly atoms. Vowels. This is in the higher school, the Prasangika school. When we take a vow, a virtuous vow to avoid killing, stealing, lying at a lay level or at an ordained level, the verbal activity of reciting a vow and say, I will keep this vow, establishes a change in a subtle physical form. Maybe it's something like people talk about an individual's aura. That, I mean, I don't see auras, but I mean, we paint them. Look, we've got auras around all the Buddhas. Has Chinrezig got, you know, Chinrezig's got his aura. So an aura is something which exists. I haven't heard it specifically said by the teachers. May well be, I don't know. But in taking a vow, we have subtle physical form. Perhaps an aura is one aspect of that. And establishing a vow creates a change in that, such that as long as we maintain the vow, that physical change becomes the cause for the constant creation of positive karma of keeping the vow. You know, like if we don't have a vow to not kill, then we only create the positive karma of not killing when there's a situation where there's an impulse or an opportunity to kill anybody, but we refrain from doing it. Then we create the positive karma of not killing. If we have the vow to not kill, then 24 hours a day, the longer we keep the vow, we accumulate the positive karma of not killing, or stealing, or lying, or sexual misconduct, whatever vows we have. So that is due to this subtle physical form. Right? Emanations. They are through the power of meditation, one's mental consciousness, a single point of concentration, can cause visible emanations in the environment, can transform the environment into the appearance of something else. You can say, through clairvoyance, you can transform a clock into a person or an elephant or whatever. And that is a functioning thing for as long as the power of consciousness is causing that to happen. So that's another example of physical form. I've mentioned space already, the physical changing space, not the unchanging space. Okay, physical things. Mental things. Our main minds, our main types of consciousness, eye, ear, smell, taste, touch consciousness, and the sixth sense, mental consciousness, these are changing moment by moment. As well as the mental factors, the whatever is existing at the time of our awareness. Every feeling of happiness, unhappiness, pleasure, pain, our neutral feeling, and our knowledge, our memories, all you know, our disturbing emotions, anger, selfishness, attachment, our constructive emotions, love, compassion, generosity. These are what were mental factors, and these are changing moment by moment. We're just briefly going through these. You've had them before, but just to put it back into context, you, as I say, if you want to ask a question, you're willing, you're free to ask as we go through. The final category of changing things is products, things which arise in dependence upon causing conditions, which are neither body nor mind. So this category underneath with the says that these are produced things that are neither body nor mind, which are designations to states that allow for the aggregation of causes and conditions and for the production, abiding, and cessation of products. So what are we talking about? Well, there are two categories. One is persons. So we all agree that there are so many persons in this room. We can count the appearance of bodies and say, yep, there's 20, 30, 40 persons. But where is the person? You know, when we point to the body, are we pointing to the person? So we check up, and although we can identify a person's name by the appearance of the body, that face, that physical shape, there's nothing within it which is the person in his or her own self. We cannot locate the person. So the person is not the body. Most of the parts of the body can be chopped off, and we can live without them, or we can even transplant somebody else's heart or lungs into this body, it's still the same person. So, person's also not the mind. We think about all the awareness, the characteristics of an individual's mind. Yes, we can recognize a person's through their sense of humor or their knowledge or the way they speak. The words they speak come from their mind. But all of those mental qualities, there is nothing which is the person in him or herself. So a person exists for sure. But when we check out on what is suitable to be called the person, the body and mind, this common, nothing can be found to be the person. So persons belong to this category of products, things which are arising from cause and conditions, but they're neither body nor mind. The second category is non-persons. So there's a few examples here. It's not exhaustive. There's a few. Acquisition. The accumulation of virtue or the accumulation of non-virtue or the non-acquisition. So let's say, you know, this person has always been self-centered, angry, and whatever, who happened to meet the teachings, and they think about it, and so they take refuge, and they start to practice Dharma. They may meditate, and their minds become very peaceful. They cultivate virtue, and they, as a person, they become different persons. You know, even their friends might say to them, "Oh, you're so nice and peaceful these days. What are you taking? What's happened to you?" So they have acquired, they have accumulated virtue. But so that collection of virtue, the actual collection itself, the virtue is karmic imprints. Karmic imprints belong to the category of things which are neither body nor mind. They belong to this category. Generosity and love, you know, virtuous minds, they belong to the mental category. So acquisition of non-virtue, like a good person, can be influenced to become a thief, live a dissolute lifestyle, and so they can change to being an unpleasant person. So they have an accumulation of non-virtue. So this collection. So that's what acquisition refers to. Next is life. Again, we say life is something which exists, but what is it? How do we determine whether a person, a human person, is alive or not alive? Well, if their eyes are open, or if they're talking, they're conscious. Or if they're not apparently conscious, but their body is warm, oh, they're alive. But if their body is really cold, they're dead. So, life is simply the state of warmth and consciousness, which we label life. That this is the we designate life to the combination of warmth and consciousness. Birth, coming to existence, aging, duration, and impermanence itself, moment by moment change. So all of these things, yes, there is birth, there is duration, and there's aging. But although aging can be ascertained by seeing changes in the body and in the mind, but the phenomenon of aging itself is neither physical nor mental. So that belongs to that category. And then region refers to a particular area, like, you know, in India there are the Himalayan region, where the geology, you know, the mountains, the waterfalls, the rivers, the snow, as well as the inhabitants, the Himalayan people, and the animals and birds of the Himalayan region are different from those of the lowland regions, near the ocean. So, it's called the area or the region is something which exists, the Himalayan region. What is it? It belongs to this category of a changing thing, it's a product, but it's neither body nor mind. Anyway, so those are just examples, an interesting list of things which are impermanent, but are neither body nor mind. Okay. Yes, question. Yeah. How does it differ from products? No, they are products. All changing things are necessarily products. But the third category is products which are neither body nor mind. So, in terms of sense objects, when we talk about the five aggregates, the body aggregate or physical aggregate includes not just this body, but includes the outer environment as well. Yeah. So I missed the first bit of the question.
You mentioned a little while ago that aging does not fall in the category of either physical or mental, unless I misunderstood that. So I'm just curious as to
Yeah.
The material body ages, so I'm curious why it's important.
Certainly, the body and the mind show signs of aging. They even show signs of life. But although, you know, wrinkles and grey hair are physical, you know, the body, and the signs of aging, they're not the phenomenon of aging itself. Aging is the general phenomenon of change. Yeah.
Is there a reason why the vow cannot be mine?
Why the vow
cannot be mine?
Is not mine? Oh, it's established by the mental action of taking the vow. But what is referred to in this context is the subtle physical the physical vows, this physical change which is only visible to the mental consciousness, not the eyes. Another one is called a non-vow. It's like if you are your job is to be a slaughter person who kills the animals at the abattoirs for consumption, even though you haven't made a vow to kill sheep or fish or whatever it is, by adopting that lifestyle and that job and permanently, that also creates a non-vow. So if you have adopted the job of being a killer of fish, you, because of the change in your subtle form, a fisherman or a slaughter person creates the negative karma of killing animals 24 hours a day. Not only when they're at work, but I'm a slaughterer, or I'm an executioner of humans. That's my job, that's my role in life. This adopting the role of executioner, they are actually creating negative karma of killing humans 24 hours a day. So sad. Okay. I put this at the beginning because even that sets us up to thinking about life and the whole thing is where we're going to talk about the wheel of life, the 12 links of dependent origination. So now we go into it, into causality in a bit more deeper way. So there are causes and conditions for material and mental things to arise. So that's when we talk about arising in dependence upon causes and conditions, we're talking about impermanent phenomena. And specifically here we're talking about physical and mental things. So for a physical thing to arise or a mental thing to arise, it has to come from a cause. In other words, something cannot come from nothing. Whatever exists must come from a cause of similar type. So, physical things arise in dependence upon physical causes of similar type. Mental things arise from mental causes of similar type. So, something cannot come from nothing. Nothing is actually, what is nothing? You can't really say what is nothing because nothing is nothing. But something is something. When I worked in New Guinea a long, long time ago, that there's a in Pidgin English, there's a really nice phrase for it doesn't matter. You know, you might be upset about something, and you maybe what the other person has done or said or whatever, and they don't say, oh look, it doesn't matter. They say, it's something nothing. Which is really nice. Yeah, it's something but nothing. Don't worry about it. Something nothing. Anyway, I just thought I'd share that. When I was writing this, I thought, oh yeah, it doesn't matter. Something nothing. So, causes, we can classify causes in many ways, but just two. Substantial cause. So, the substantial cause of physical things is a continuum of matter. And matter is very broad. It embraces not only atoms and molecules, but it embraces the energies of electromagnetic energy, gravitational energy, and so on. But what we observe is they belong to the material world. Einstein's formula E equals mc squared talks of the relationship between energy and matter. They're interchangeable. So substantial cause. Substantial cause of mind. As mind is not a physical phenomenon, no, awareness, the continuum of awareness, which is definition of mind, clarity and awareness, then it has no physical properties. You can't talk about colour of mind, shape of mind, weight of mind, or whatever. But awareness exists. So, its substantial cause has to be something of similar type. Matter does not have awareness. And also awareness doesn't have matter. So, the substantial cause of mind, of consciousness, and happiness, unhappiness, etc., cannot be the physical world. But mind exists. Awareness, knowledge, memories exist. So, there's the so-called substance. That's, in English, substance sort of implies something substantial, material. But if we look at in a more broad sense, when we talk about substance or what is the stuff of awareness, what is the substance or stuff of happiness, unhappiness, it is consciousness itself. So, we talk about mind being a stream of awareness, so we have a present moment at the present time of awareness. Its substantial cause is the immediately preceding moment of awareness, that moment from the immediate past, which has stopped because everything's changing moment by moment. So as the prior moment of consciousness stops, it becomes the substantial cause for the present moment of awareness. And when the present moment of awareness ceases, as it inevitably will, because it's an impermanent phenomenon, it becomes the substantial cause for the future moment of awareness. So, all the qualities that exist in the mind at the present moment, the virtuous qualities and non-virtuous qualities, their seeds, are transmitted from past to present to future. And so you have a continuum, and you could say it's the same mind stream overall, but it's an ever-changing mind stream. The qualities are ever-changing. But there is this continuum. So the substantial cause of mind is awareness. And then, of course, this goes back to the scientific world, which presents mind as being the product of the brain, the electrochemical activity of the brain. But the brain, the activity of the brain, which is a physical phenomenon, can only produce physical products. it does not have the stuff of awareness, the substance of awareness, to produce mind. So from the Buddhist point of view, mind is not a product of the activity of the brain and nervous system. However, the second is cooperative conditions. So we're not talking about substantial cause now, we're talking about cooperative conditions. And yes, the activity of the sense organs and the brain, the nervous system, is indeed a cooperative condition for awareness, for emotions, positive emotions, for memories, for knowledge. All mental aspects of our human mind depend upon our human body as cooperative condition. So you see, we distinguish between substantial cause and cooperative condition. In terms of the physical world, if you have a seed, right, then the substantial cause of the seed is the the pollen grain, and the meeting of the male and female aspects in the flower. The whole purpose of a flower is to join up the pollen grain and the, I forget the biological term for, but anyway, it's quite similar to animals. This male and female chromosomes come together in dependence upon the flower and the bees and birds, and you have the formation of the seed. So that's the substantial cause of a seed. But for the seed to germinate, you need cooperative conditions. The seed needs to meet moisture, warmth, sunlight, etc., which will then cause it to germinate. If it's kept in the dark, no light, no moisture, it will not germinate. It needs these cooperative conditions. Cooperative condition for anger is the seed of anger in the mind, and then the object of at some meeting through karma, an unpleasant object, anger. Cooperative condition for attachment is meeting a pleasing object, and so the mind generates attachment. It's a cooperative condition. All right, so substantial cause and cooperative conditions. Then, so things, impermanent things, depend upon causes, and so they're results. Cause gives rise to the result, and in giving rise to the result, the cause ceases. And because the result is only momentary, it's impermanent, it becomes a cause, in turn, of a future result. So impermanence is the second thing. If you don't have this quality of moment-by-moment change, then nothing can produce a result. It's like we talk about permanent space. That can't produce a result. It is just there, all the time, everywhere, unchanging. Things can pass through it, but it doesn't create movement. The world, the earth, has its own movement. Space is just this emptiness of contact. The third point, in the arising of impermanent things, there has to be a potentiality to produce a corresponding result, which means that the result necessarily corresponds to some potential in the cause. Example, we've talked about the development of a seed in a plant. So if you have an apple flower, produces an apple seed, and that apple seed can only germinate to produce an apple tree, which produces apples. It can never produce bananas. Because it has this potential to produce apples when the conditions are there. And also our emotions, you know, we all have the seeds of anger, the seeds of love, the seeds of compassion in the mind stream. These are subtle types of consciousness. And so when the mind in general, through the constant ripening of karma, meets different situations, pleasant and unpleasant, then when there is a seed of love, there is a suitable object of love, and if other conditions are suitable, love manifests in the mind, or anger, again, to manifest in the mind in those situations. If there is no seed of anger, even in the face of harmful experiences, no anger can arise. There is no potential. There is no anger. And what is the situation when there's no anger? It's not when anger is suppressed. Like if you meditate and you generate the form or formless realm absorptions, all disturbing emotion afflictions are suppressed. And they cannot manifest in those states, meditative state or a rebirth state, but the seed's still there. And when their karma ceases for that form or formless realm rebirth, they're reborn in the desire realm, and they still have the seed of anger, so the affliction can manifest when the situation is there. So the only time when disturbing emotions cannot arise is when true cessation has been achieved through the wisdom directly realizing emptiness. And so if there are no seeds of anger, anger cannot manifest in the mind. Of course, we know there are levels of anger. There's gross and medium and subtle, you know, you can break it down. So gross anger can't arise. Subtle anger can arise. Up until you become a bodhisattva on the eighth ground, then you have no more afflictions. I think His Holiness has once said a long time ago, in a certain teaching situation, I think somebody asked him, "Do you ever get angry?" And he said, "Sometimes the impulse to be angry manifests, but that impulse does not flower into full-blown anger in the mind." He has the wisdom power to stop the impulse. So I think it was Lama Zopa said, when His Holiness said that, he was implying he was on such and such a bodhisattva's ground. Not yet the eighth ground. But it was an answer for a particular questioner. And other times it seems that His Holiness was actually a Buddha. No impulse for anger. So answers, even Buddha gave answers to questions according to the capacity of the person to understand. I think I've told you the example of the time when Lambieshi was teaching in Australia, and like a general talk at Melbourne University, and somebody asked him, "What is karma?" And Lama Yeshe said, he answered, "You are karma." And somebody at the back said, "I didn't understand the answer to that question." And Lama Yeshe said, "No, because the answer was for her, not for you." So, His Holiness, just like the Buddha, He gives answers to questions according for the person who asks a question. And I think, I have no doubt, that His Holiness is not just a fifth or sixth level ground bodhisattva. I think He's a beyond the tenth ground, that is a Buddha. Alright, so you see, we're thinking about causes and conditions because we're moving towards the 12 links of dependent origination. We're laying the ground for understanding them. So, now time for a break, and we'll move on after lunch.